Welcome to The Conversation on KMUN. I'm your host, Graham, and today we are departing from our normal format of being a live call-in show. So sorry to disappoint you, but you can hang your phone back up. I know you're eager to call with your comments or questions. We have a pre-taped show for you today featuring the executive director of Oregon Black Pioneers. He's been in the position since July, and he's here to tell us a little bit about himself and about the work that his organization is doing. Welcome to the program, Zachary Stocks. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Graham. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So how about we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself and your background?
For sure. Yeah. So my name is Zachary Stocks. I live here in Astoria. And since July, I've been the executive director of Oregon Black Pioneers. I just started this role after getting laid off due to COVID-19, something a lot of us have found ourselves in that same situation. Most recently, I was working for an exhibit design firm, put up a few exhibitions at Oregon Historical Society and is soon to open Corvallis Museum. And immediately before that, I was the program director at Grays Harbor Historical Seaport, which runs the tall ships Lady Washington and Hawaiian Chieftain that sail up and down the West Coast. So I was their program director, which basically meant I was in charge of whatever experience you would have when you step aboard the boat, from a tour to a sail, an educational field trip for kids. So I oversaw that work. I'm originally from Virginia, and I always knew I wanted to work in museums or around history education in particular. So I studied early American history, 17th, 18th, and 19th century in Virginia, and then got an internship for a year at Colonial Williamsburg and did that for a while, interned at the National Park Service and at Smithsonian. And then it was time to go to grad school. So I went to the University of Washington, which brought me out west. I moved with my partner, Ginger, and we lived in Seattle for about four and a half years. And while I was there, I was the front of house manager for the Northwest African American Museum. So in that role, I mostly was in charge of day-to-day front of house activities, everything from volunteers, visitor services. I oversaw our security staff, as well as our interns, our public reading room, tours, docent training, things like that. And then when I got the job at the tall ships, we were able to move to the coast, which is what brought us to Astoria. We just decided, let's move anywhere where we're going to be out of the city and that I can be within a reasonable drive of Aberdeen, Washington, which is where Historical Seaport is based. So came to the coast, been here for 3.5 years in Astoria now, and it's been great. Ginger works over at the Wildlife Center of the North Coast, and I work out of my home office here in town.
So before we move on to talking a little bit more about your organization and some Oregon history, I'm curious what ignited your interest in history and how what got you on the path? What made you so passionate about this field of study?
You know, it's funny. I tell people it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. And for me as a kid, we didn't have any money growing up. And I lived pretty close to Washington, D.C. So my dad and I, in particular, would go to Smithsonian museums because they were free. And we went to a lot of historic houses, a lot of living history museums. And there was just something about it. I don't know. I think it's the ability to sort of see the past with your own two eyes that was really appealing to me. So I knew that's the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I've done everything I can to try to get as involved as possible in making that part of my career and also my personal pursuits. I volunteer now as an interpretive ranger at Lewis and Clark National Historical Park too. So even though, you know, I don't get paid for that work, it's the only thing I really like to do. So
great.
I'm all about it.
Great. Well, thanks for your work.
Yeah.
So tell us about Oregon Black Pioneers.
Yeah, for sure. So Oregon Black Pioneers is a nonprofit. We were founded in 1993, and it's incorporated in Salem. The headquarters is still in Salem, but I'm going to be working here in Astoria out of my home office and commuting in a couple times a month for some of the more administrative duties, banking, things like that. So for almost 30 years, this has been a completely volunteer organization. It's been led just by a working board of directors. And when I was hired at the beginning of this month, I became their first ever paid staff person, and obviously their first executive director as well. But Oregon Black Pioneers is Oregon's only statewide African-American historical society. There's no other organization that is telling people about the history of Black people that have made a life here or even just visited this area in a comprehensive way. There might be some organizations that talk about Oregon Black military veterans or about a particular town. But for us, we're really interested in the stories of all Black people who've made a life here in the state. Originally, when the organization was founded, the focus was more on like Black trailblazers, people who came here on the Oregon Trail and in the first decades of the 19th century. That was mostly an attempt to document as comprehensively as possible all the Black Oregonians in the state's early settlement period. And that sort of emerged after an early documentation project that found that in the Pioneer Cemetery in Salem, there were over 40 Black individuals buried there who were from the 19th century. And so there were no markers for them, though. They were all unmarked graves. And so the organization decided, you know, we need to really let people know that among our pioneer history, that there were Black people in that story as well. And so they worked to find out who these individuals were who were buried there and as much information about their life stories as possible, and then to erect a monument to those Black pioneers in this pioneer cemetery. And from there, the organization started to professionalize a bit and focused more on exhibitions and programs to continue to tell that story. Today, the focus, though, is less on that 1800s and more about focusing on the sharing the experiences of Oregon's historic Black communities, the industries that brought people here, and also the legal and social environments that they entered into. So it's not limited to the 1800s. I'm really interested in exploring stories about Black Oregonians from the 1500s through today. So it's less about Black firsts or famous individuals, and instead it's more important that we can focus on contemporary connections between the experiences of our ancestors and also the circumstances that we find ourselves in today. So it's hopefully a much more inclusive Oregon Black Pioneers than it has been for the past 30 years in terms of our representation of women and also of other communities of color. And hopefully that means we're a more relevant organization for the time that we're in right now.
I'm interested to know how the board was able to take the leap from a fully working board, volunteer-based organization to getting their first staff member. Did you get some grant funding for the position?
We did. So the organization is pretty savvy in terms of finding grants out there and presenting a plan for what they're going to do with those funds. And like I mentioned, most of the fundraising has been around specific projects that the organization has undertaken. But Oregon Cultural Trust put out a grant that was about operational growth, and they were able to secure a pretty large grant to be able to bring in their first paid staff person. And I'm really thankful that they chose me.
That's great. Yeah. Before we go on to some more history, tell me a little bit more about some of the things that your organization does.
For sure. So historically, Oregon Black Pioneers has shared the experiences of African Americans in the state through its original exhibitions and also a few publications, a few books that we've produced. So for me, I want to really refine what our program offerings are to just a few key places that we can do really well, and that important for today, we can do remotely. And so those are three things that I want to focus on. First, I really want us to develop a virtual museum where we can share our collection and the research and content that we already have, and keep those things on an accessible format so people can actually see the different photographs of communities of African Americans throughout Oregon's history. They can see an interactive map where they can find out what are the sites with African American historical significance near me. The second thing is to revive our Speakers Bureau program and work with authors, historians, and some knowledgeable experts to host talks related to other events going on in the community. And we can do that via Zoom. So that's something we can get started right away. And the third is to continue to identify and commemorate statewide sites with African-American historical significance. So we want to add these to that map that I mentioned, but also advocate for new interpretive signage and working through partner museums, through state entities like Oregon Heritage or Oregon Historical Society, the State Historical Markers Program, try to put up permanent markers to just let people know that African-American history exists all over Oregon and that it's closer than you think.
Well, that sounds like a great plan. What's your time frame for getting all this done as a part-time single staff member of an organization?
Well, it's in the works already. All of those things I've already gotten started on. So the website is being overhauled right now. And what we're going to be able to do is build in that embedded map feature. We're even taking in a little bit of crowdsourcing. So getting the information online and putting it there so people can just access it with a click. The Speakers Bureau program, right now I'm talking with some of the people who've worked with us in the past and seeing if they'd be interested in doing some video talks. And believe me, we've got a ton of requests. People are really interested in finding out right now about the history of African Americans in Oregon. So there's no shortage of interest in having someone from our organization go out and talk to people. And then in terms of identifying new sites, I've been in conversations already with Oregon Heritage and with the travel information group that puts up the historic markers to find out what is that process. And, is there a way for us to recognize the fact that there has been a lack of attention to African-American history here and think about an equitable way for us to bring those stories to the front? Because there can be a substantial waiting list for a sign. But again, given the amount of public attention that African-American history in Oregon is getting right now, I think that it's really crucial that we don't miss this momentum and we can work hard to share these stories with people and raise the funds. It's my job to raise the funds to then put those signs up.
I'm curious, and disclaimer, we can leave this question out if you're not interested in answering it, but to what extent does the current movement empower you in your work, and to what extent is it currently burdening you in your work? Because I know that from my end, as I reach out to people looking for good information or looking for resources, everyone is getting asked about this right now. I know that, you must be getting calls all day long for requests for interviews like we're doing now. Or is it a combination of both? Is this empowering your organization? Is it burdening it? Is it somewhere in between?
I would say that it's a little bit of both. It's really great that a lot of businesses in particular are starting to look at their institutions and recognizing where they have been lapsed in addressing systemic racism in the histories of their organizations and also in their hiring practices and how seriously they take claims of discrimination from their employees and that they're committing themselves to new equity work. That's awesome. But I think it's weird that they're reaching out to our organization because as a historical society, there's very little that we can provide them in terms of resources to start to mitigate those things or to correct from the missteps they've had in the past, right? So I hope that organizations would do a little bit more research in finding out who is the most appropriate person to call, because there are plenty of organizations in Oregon and in the Pacific Northwest that are Black-led or POC-led that specifically address workplace discrimination or racial equity trainings. And we're not an organization that can do that. We don't have the capacity and I don't have that expertise. But in terms of what we can offer, I really believe that we need to address our history in order to be able to really understand the circumstances that we find ourselves in today, right? So that for us involves the truth-telling aspect, and then the reconciliation comes later. And I think that what we can offer is a very clear understanding of the fact that racism is embedded in the structures of this state, and it always has been, and it was intentional. And that is the reason that this state remains so white today. It's only 2.2% African-American in the state of Oregon. That's a consequence of intentional political decisions that have been made from the territorial days through today. And that the Black people that are here are concentrated in a few very segregated communities. And from that, I hope people can take that information and apply it to what they see in the news to, if they're asking themselves, why is there this uproar in Portland of all places about police violence? Well, I can give them a little bit of history about, the history of police interventions in Albina in 1967 or in the 1980s when Lloyd Stevenson was choked out by police officers, and then Portland police officers sold T-shirts that said "choke 'em and smoke 'em" to other officers. I mean, these things are not out of the blue, right? And so the response that we see now, in some ways, I feel is the federal government with the federal officers. This could be a testing ground for what they think could be possible in terms of a policing model and riot suppression, as they'll call it, in cities across America. And maybe they think that people won't notice it here because the population of African Americans here is much smaller. But what we can do is educate people and let them know that while we may be small, the history is rich and these are not without precedent.
That's a really interesting take on them prioritizing Portland as the first place to deploy those troops. I hadn't put it in that context, so thank you. How shall we move on? Do you want to get into some history?
Let's do it, yeah. How about a little history of African Americans on the North Coast? I pulled some figures for you.
That'd be great.
So, let's see. Honestly, the earliest knowledge that we have of Black people in Oregon kind of begins on the North Coast. There is an awesome book that just came out last year by an author named Melissa Darby, and it's called Thunder Go North. And she contends that Sir Francis Drake of England actually landed on the Oregon coast in 1579 at a site called Whale Cove, which is just south of Depot Bay. And for many, many years, people have assumed that Drake's Good and Fair Bay, as he called it, was in California. But she makes a pretty compelling case using linguistic evidence, archaeology, and also mapping of the coastline and the maps that Drake drew, that it was actually in Oregon, and that there are political reasons why they would want to call it California, both in Drake's time to be able to claim more land north of that for England, and then in later days in the 1900s as a way of Californians trying to have connections to a white English origin story for the history of the peopling of the West. But with Sir Francis Drake, if they did land in Whale Cove, with him were four Black passengers. There was a pregnant woman named Maria, who had been taken from a Spanish ship where she was enslaved. There was a man named Diego, who was from Panama, and he was an escaped slave who had joined Drake's crew and had been sailing with him since 1572. And then there were two other Panamanians who were freed from the gallows by Drake's crew when they started to shell this village as they pirated up and down the West Coast. So those four Black people came with him and stayed for 3 weeks on the coast. And then afterwards, when the ship left and went across Asia, he left Maria and the two Panamanians in the South Pacific, and Diego died a few months later in the Philippines, I believe. So if that's true, then that predates other known African Americans in Oregon by over 200 years. And, you know, 1579, that is really early when we start to think about the populating of the western portions of North America. So when we think about who was in Oregon first, there really isn't a time where there weren't African Americans here. As long as there have been white people in Oregon, there have been Black people in Oregon. And I think that's a really important point to make. The next African American that we know of who came to the North Coast was Marcus Lopez, who we actually have a lot of documentation of. He was on the crew of the Lady Washington, which was captained by Robert Gray. And, you know, folks, listeners here will know that Robert Gray is the captain who later captains the Columbia Redaviva, where the Columbia River gets its name. Well, before he did that in 1792, he came part of a earlier voyage to the Pacific Northwest in 1788. And when they landed on the Tillamook coast, Marcus Lopez and the rest of the crew had hopped out. They were trading with the local tribes. And as Lopez was sitting in the sand, a Tillamook tribal member took his sword. And so Lopez ran after him, and he ended up actually being stabbed with his own sword by that person. And after that, the crew got back on the boat and they fled. So unfortunately, Marcus Lopez has the dubious honor of also being the first Black person to die in Oregon. But that was 1788. And, you know, it's possible that there were other black sailors, either free or enslaved, on British, Spanish, or American ships that came to the Columbia River area in the North Coast, particularly between the 1780s and around 1800, when there was a lot of trade ships coming to the area. But if they were on there, we don't have documentation of them. There's no way for us to know for sure. But considering that black people worked in the maritime trade quite substantially, then it's very likely that there were more black residents, or excuse me, black visitors to the North Coast at that time. The next person that we know for sure of was York from the Lewis and Clark expedition. So that was in 1805. York was William Clark's enslaved personal servant, and he was a member of the Corps of Discovery who came with them from St. Louis, Missouri to the Pacific Ocean and wintered with everyone else at Fort Clatsop here in Astoria. We know that York was the only member of the party who didn't get any sort of compensation for his labor, despite the fact that he was a general laborer and a hunter for the party. And when you read through the Lewis and Clark journals, you'll see that he was treated as every other member of the Corps. But we have to recognize that, you know, when they got back home, the circumstances resumed in terms of our racialized differences that we, you know, that the country had placed on black people. And because of that, he went right back to his enslaved status, despite having so much freedom while on the actual trip across the West.
And being treated equitably on a personal level, but not on a financial level, it sounds like.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about what happened to York after they got back, right? So the only account we have of what happened to him later comes from Washington Irving, who, in addition to writing like Sleepy Hollow, also wrote a couple of histories. And he spoke to William Clark and documented the stories of what happened to all the members of the party. And Clark says that he freed York later on, but it's not actually clear whether or not that's true. He got set up in a shipping company, and it just so happens that, and this was in Louisville, Kentucky, and Clark had relatives who were in that same trade, also in Louisville. So it also could be interpreted that maybe he just sent York to go and work for his relatives as opposed to working for him, because at this point Clark was living in Missouri. So whether or not it's true is unclear. We do know that York had a wife who he never had a chance to see again, and he petitioned Clark to let him see him, and Clark chastised him for, you know, for hounding him so often about wanting to see his wife. So pretty ugly story. And then later than that, you know, in the following decades after Astoria was founded in 1811, we know that there were independent traders and fur trappers working for the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company, or selling wares individually who came here. And we know plenty about African-Americans who were in the fur trapping industry, but we don't have names of any individuals. So again, it's likely that more black people came here in the first two decades of the 1800s. But we don't have a name that we can associate with it. And then the last one that I pulled for you today is in 1841, we know of a fellow named Jim Sauls. And he was a free black sailor from Connecticut who joined the Wilkes expedition, which explored Antarctica. And on the way back, they stopped in the Pacific Northwest. And so while they were on the Columbia River, they ran aground and had to do some repairs. And it was during that time that he left the expedition. So he set up in Astoria for a time, and we know that he and one other black person were whipped and chased out of town because of some sort of violation that they committed. We don't know what that was. And so he left, and he eventually set up a homestead near Cape Disappointment and married a Chinook woman, and then moved to Oregon City. And while he was there, he is someone who purchased a horse from a fella named William Anderson, or Winslow Anderson. And that horse had already been promised to a Wasco Indian man named Comstock. And because Sauls had that horse, Comstock felt he had been cheated, and so he went to go and retrieve it and stole it from Sauls. And in the aftermath of that, Comstock led a raid in Oregon City with two others, and three people died. And so even though Saul's was sort of an unintentional party to this incident, which became known as the Comstock Affair, it was in the aftermath of the Comstock Affair that some of Oregon's first exclusion laws were passed, because there was an association between, you know, riffraff when black people are in the state. So again, you know, it's a situation where he hadn't actually perpetuated any incidents of violence, and yet violence was the result of the incident, and the group that suffered from that was African Americans. When the state started to pass some of its first laws that outlawed black residency.
So with a little bit of time left, do you want to get into some of those exclusionary laws?
Yeah, sure. So let's see. So Oregon Territory and then Oregon State passed three black exclusion laws. The first one it outlawed slavery and said that slaves in the state would be freed, but slave owners had 2 years to remove their slaves and their male slaves, and 3 years to remove their female slaves from the state. And once these people were freed, they had to leave right away. And if they didn't leave, then they would be lashed. So that was passed by someone named Peter Burnett. He was in the territorial government, and it became known as Peter Burnett's Lash Law. Peter Burnett went on to become the first governor of California. And the lashings were no less than 22 and no more than 29 per person. As we understand, no one was actually lashed under that law, but nonetheless, it was the first black exclusion law that Oregon passed. And it was followed by a couple others. The next one said that it was unlawful for Negroes or mulattoes to reside in Oregon. And there was a Portland business owner named Jacob Vanderpool who was expelled from the state by a white competitor who reported him. And so that just said explicitly that black people can't reside in Oregon. And then in the Oregon Bill of Rights, when the state came into existence, it outlawed black residency. It outlawed black property ownership and land claims. And it also outlawed blacks from making contracts or for bringing suit against whites. So in essence, it created a whites-only state and excluded blacks from the legal protections in our Constitution. And so Oregon was actually the first state to enter the United States with black exclusionary laws on the books. And this wasn't repealed until 1926, that last one. In fact, Oregon was one of only six states that didn't ratify the 15th Amendment, which gave blacks the vote. That didn't happen until the state centennial in 1959. And Oregon only ratified the 14th Amendment, which is the Equal Protection Under the Law Clause, in 1973. And that was only after the first black state legislator pushed for it. He made it a priority. And as I mentioned before, blacks were excluded from the Donation Land Act of 1850. And obviously there's been a really strong presence of the Ku Klux Klan in Oregon as well. So in the 1920s in particular, Oregon was a place where, Klan membership was as many as 43,000 people at a time when the state population was only 830,000. So about 5% of all Oregon residents were members of the Klan, at least, you know, embedded into the earliest documents of Oregon's statehood. And they're the consequences of racial injustice that we see today are really a result of some of these earliest laws that are here, and why there has never really been a substantial African-American community in the state.
Well, I think we should wrap up. I wish we could spend more time chatting, but I hope you come back to the station and give us a little bit more history. I'm really happy that Oregon Cultural Trust was able to support your organization with some funding for your salary. And I, for one, know that grants don't happen without some buy-in from the community as well, and so matching funds. If anyone in our listening audience was interested in supporting your organization, what's a good place to go to find out how to do that, and what kind of support do you need the most right now?
The support we need most right now is financial support. If listeners are able to make a contribution to Oregon Black Pioneers, if they believe that these stories are worth telling, which I hope they do, then they can support that work by making even small monetary contributions to allow us to put up new signs, to pay for the website improvements that are happening right now. Every gift really makes a difference, and we're certainly appreciative of that. And they can make that just by going to our website right now, which is OregonBlackPioneers.org.
OregonBlackPioneers.org. And if you value this type of history as much as we do at the station, and you have anecdotes, journals, archives that you think might be of interest or value to the organization, I'm sure that you'd be happy to receive those as well.
Yeah, for sure. I would always want to review that with the board. So please, if you have photos or documents or stories related to African American history in Oregon from the earliest days or the civil rights movement, really anything, let us know. It's hello@OregonBlackPioneers.org.
I want to express my gratitude to Zachary Stocks, Executive Director of Oregon Black Pioneers. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Graham. Yeah, it was fun.
Take care.